Welcome to the Up the Cream podcast, episode 17. I'm Dan Tomlinson, and I'm joined as always by Rich Harrison, aka Pommy. Rich, how you doing, mate?
I'm very well, mate. And you?
Yeah, spot on, thanks, pal. Another good win, a different sort of win, as Hull beat Huddersfield 17-10 on Friday night, but they all count after all, don't they?
Yeah, mate. Chalk and cheese from the week before. We had to battle for this one and a bit of adversity and you know. A 17-man squad that, if you'd have put that to any Hull fan at the start of the season, would have gone, who's that? What, he's back? What, really? So, I mean, yeah, we count that as a great win, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. No fewer than 13 first team players given squad numbers at the start or midway through this year, out for either injury, international call up or personal reasons, and one of those dropping out literally an hour before the game. You know, two teenage lads thrown in who've never been in the first team environment before, another returning on loan, you know, a makeshift winger thrown in from the army on the left wing. That goes down. That's nuts, isn't it? That's about as makeshift team as you can get, but, you know, the effort, the grit, the determination within Hull FC right now is absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, totally. And you know, let's not forget Cam Scott coming back from a shoulder injury, who's played all of his career at centre, being thrown in the second row as well. You know, that's phenomenal.
Yeah, it is. It's ridiculous. And like you say, that win was probably more satisfying in some respects to the league game, because the league game was I know people called it a potential banana skin and whatnot, but for me, it was a game that was never going to be anything less than a Hull FC win. Admittedly, I didn't expect Hull to score 12 tries and 64 points that day, but, you know, not many would have expected Hull to lose at Lay-In. But, yeah, but this one was more satisfied because of those, you know, those scenarios that we've just, you know, spoken about and them circumstances. And to pull that out of the bag the way they did, you know, 10-0 down at half-time, you're thinking, oh, God, you know, this could get ugly. But Hull just never backed down, do they? They keep going, they keep fighting. And eventually they got the reward. And, you know, three really good tries as well. No surprises, all orchestrated by Mark Snead. And cut out ball to Matthew Fanua was superb. The two kicks were brilliant as well. But him and Josh Reynolds, they stood up and they led that team. They were, you know, they were galvanising everyone. And they were revving up the young lads as well. And yeah, that was just a proper half-back performance from both of them. They popped up all over the field. They took the game by the scruff of the neck and, you know, delivered for the side.
Yeah, absolutely. And some gargantuan efforts as regards some of the stats as well. Vuliki Japani, three tackle busts, you know, 14 runs for 144 metres. That's pretty impressive for a winger, isn't it? And, you know, Fanua and Farimo with 80-odd metres apiece. And, you know, then you look at Mao and Liggy Sow over 150 and Brad Fash at 133. And, mate, that's a hard-fought win. That's a very, very hard-fought win.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So the halfbacks were great. I mean, two that really stood out for me were Liggy Sow and Manu Mau, two of our big import signings. And Liggy Sow had to step up with no Chris Satter because that farcical England game. And Manu Mau, who's been brilliant for weeks on end now, he's running a little bit wider, it must be said. He's not just getting used as a battering ram now, but it's the only way he knows, isn't it? It's just full on, run 100 miles an hour, crash like water in rock into his opposition, and when he hits as well, you bloody know about it because he smashes them, and just everything he does is just full on, and he's been superb for weeks on end. But I thought, yeah, Liggy Sow was outstanding. His two stints, I think, were 30 and 32 minutes, so, you know, that's a colossal effort for a front row forward.
Yeah, and you know, who'd have thought at the start of the year that Liggy Sow would be our pack leader? You know, you just wouldn't, would you? And it's just, we've just instilled something into this squad. So, you know, we're going to have to face facts. Hodgson is a bloody good coach. He really is, you know, because he's getting really, really good performances out of squads that you'd, on paper, you'd think would fold like a pack of cards, you know, with no Satai, with no Scott Taylor, with players out and players injured and players not playing and stuff, and you know, and with no Sevilla and all the rest of it. You look at that squad 12 months ago, on paper you'd think, yeah, we'll fold. There's no way we'll beat Huddersfield, especially after going 10-0 down. But we're different gravy this year. We really are. And the only difference is it's Hodgson. That's the only difference. Hodgson and Reynolds are the only two things that are different from this time last year.
Probably argue Gareth Ellis has a voice in that setup as well.
Yeah.
It was one thing I didn't really pick up on at the time, but at Castleford away, you know, stood behind the behind the sticks on the terrace. You could see him coming on and barking instructions out as a trainer, and that was good to see. And no one's telling me that no one's, you know, not buying into the influence that he has after the playing career he did and the respect he commands. But you're absolutely bang on. Brett Hodgson's obviously coming to this club. He's took everything by the scruff of the neck, and he's delivering, isn't he? He says all the right things. You know, he's full of class, never whinges, just gets on with it. It was interesting to see Ian Watson whinge straight away this week and crying wolf, saying, you know, we've got this bloke out and this one out. Hodgson just gets on with it. You know, he's full of class, and you can't buy that. I mean, that was, like you say, a depleted side, one decimated by players out for various reasons. And, you know, you're looking at that squad this time last year, even this time, 2019, back in the 2018, they get hammered. And we saw that, didn't we? We saw under similar circumstances, and even with squads that were a lot more strong than the one on Friday, we saw all sides get battered, and it was embarrassing, you know, when you're talking 50, 60, 70, and even 80-point defeats. And that's why, you know, fans cried foul when they saw the unacceptable, because that's not good enough. But we don't get that now, because we don't feel sorry for ourselves. We don't whinge about any circumstance or any situation. We just get on with it, and that's all installed from, obviously, Brett Hodgson at the top. And it's brilliant to see, because, you know, you say all we want as fans is want to see effort. You know, I just want to see a bloke, you know, a group of blokes come together, which they have done this year, and give it their all. And they've done that every week, regardless of the result. And as a fan, you can get behind that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the only people that you'd say in that squad that were probably the first choice, you know, you'd say, well, arguably, Mao's probably a first choice second rower. Sow's probably a first choice pack player, whether he plays at lock or whether he plays at or whether he plays at prop or second row. Sneed and Reynolds are first choice, and Fanua's first choice. But apart from that, nobody else. You got your third choice fullback. You got your second choice hooker. You've got bench players in Fash and Brown. You know, you got Ben McNamara coming off the bench. You've got a bloke who at the start of the season was a project, and we didn't even really offer a full-time contract to until the first week of the season, which is Vuli Kichapani. And then you're bringing Jack Logan back from Batley on loan, and you're giving a debut to two teenagers off the bench as well, although one didn't get on. You've got two teenagers on the bench as well that have never been anywhere near the first grid. You know, what an effort that is. That's amazing. You know, and Huddersfield, yeah, they had some players out as well, but I don't think they had the adversity that we had.
When you look at Huddersfield's squad, it was a lot more experience that, you know, them holded. And yes, they had players out. Yes, they had five playing for the, you know, the farcical rebranded Exile side that played at Warrington on Friday night. But you still had your Aston Goldings, your Lee Gaskells, your James Gavertz. There was still a lot of quality in that side. And I thought it just spoke volumes about the difference in the two clubs. Huddersfield just say they whinge, they want to get the game off straight away. Watson's whinging in the media. Hull and Hodgson just get on with it. Must admit, that decision would be swayed a lot by the fact that Hull have organised the game at the K-Con. We know the score right now with the Alums. Hull have got a fork out their start of 50k. You can guarantee that if they did call that off, the Alums would want another 50k for whenever it was rescheduled. You can guarantee that. You know, 100% they wouldn't have let them off and, you know, rescheduled it.
They've got to go.
Yeah, 100%.
They've got to go.
Yeah, 100%. But yeah, that, I know, like I say, I know it was obviously swayed by the Alum factor, but even still, you know, just roll your sleeves up, get on with it. And that's been the story of Hull FC all season. They haven't moaned about anything. They haven't moaned about any situation in regards to fixtures or anything like that. The fact that they've just had to play five games on the road in between two home games, which is a joke, for a pitch that got relayed that didn't even have to be relayed in the first place. Just get on with everything, don't they? And that is absolutely brilliant to see.
Yeah, totally. And you know what? I'd like to think that obviously we're going to get a few bodies back in the next couple of weeks, especially with the Rovers game being postponed. But we're going to get a few bodies back and everything. I would like to think that we could find a place for Jack Logan in our squad moving forward. I think he's better than Batley. I really do. And I think it was a shame that he left when he left. And I mean, he'll always be a hero to us for scoring a hat-trick against Rovers in that derby. But at the end of the day, I'd really like to see Jack Logan back in a Hull shirt, even as a fringe squad player or whatever. I think he's useful to us, and he can play a number of back positions and stuff, and probably could even double up at hooker or something like that as well. I'd really like to think we could find a place back for him.
Yeah, it was a tough one when he left back end of 2019 because Kieran Buchanan left obviously the year after as well, and they both went to Batley, and the two lads that were, you know, good people to have around the place. Obviously, they're well liked. You know, they've come through the systems at all, and you know, they could be relied upon when, you know, when called. And yeah, it was sad to see them both go. It's nice to see Kieran. I know exactly why Kieran went. He needed the week in, week out rugby. You know, with the farcical situation of the reserve set up. He was playing at all, and then if he weren't in the first team, it could be 3 or 4 weeks before he'd game again. Whereas at Batley, he's had some continuity where at least he's playing, you know, week in, week out every Sunday. Jack Logan's is probably the same. He was probably getting a bit sick of it, especially when you think he had the knee injury, which kept him out for the best part of 2 years. Also, reoccurring ACL problems and what have you. And he's at a stage of his career now where he's probably thinking, do I want to be at Hull FC, you know, at age 25 and playing, you know, bit part here and there and out, with no reserves set up. He's probably thinking, right, I will go to Batley then. At least I get, you know, that game time week in, week out. And that's the problem. And I absolutely 100% agree with you that I would love Jack Logan to still be in Hull FC squad. And the same with Kieran Buchanan. But at the same time, you know, you understand why these players, they do maybe drop down a level. And they both are better than Batley. And that's no disrespect to Batley, but they are better than that. They're a, you know, a lower end Super League standard, an absolute West, you know, they're much better than Championship. They both should be playing in Super League week in, week out.
Yeah, I mean, if you offered me Luke Briscoe or Jack Logan, I'd take Jack Logan
every day of the week. Yeah, every hour of the day, every minute of the hour. Yeah, 100%.
When was the last time we saw a young Hull-born winger beat someone for pace on the outside? You know?
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, the try he got against Rovers when he literally rounded Craig all that time, that was brilliant.
Yeah, wasn't it? And you could see the look on his face when he went round him, thinking, oh my God, I'm going to score a hat trick.
Yeah,
you could see the moment. It's just amazing.
Well, that's what I like about young players, because they do show more emotion, don't they? And Jack Logan, when he went up, and obviously leaped higher than any Huddersfield player to get that Mark Snead ball and plonk it down, you know, he was absolutely buzzing, belted the ball into the sky, you know, fist pump, he jumped about 3 feet in the air. And same with Conor Wynne, when he grounded the Snead rubber in the in goal, you know, his celebration was pretty telling, you know. And that showed a lot of balls and a lot of character from people like Conor Wynne and Jack Logan as well, who did make a couple of errors, it must be said, in the first half. And, you know, you can quite easily get fazed by that and your head can go down, but it don't revolt. They just keep going, and I love that, because you've got to back yourself, because, you know, your mistakes happen. It's part and parcel of sport. And if you are going to play, you know, an expansive attacking brand of rugby, then mistakes will come, but it's how you respond to that. And that's what I love about Hull FC, and that's what I loved about the performance at Castleford, because we were never fazed by errors. We kept going, eventually nailed by execution. Same against Huddersfield, we get 3 players and 3 good tries to win the game. And yeah, fair play to those 2 lads. And again, it was just, I just loved the fact that, you know, the senior players in the Hull side that did actually play, in your Mark Sneeds and your Josh Reynolds, they were the ones galvanising everyone. They were the ones saying, come on, boys, this ain't over yet. And they were the ones that, you know, got that victory and, you know, scraped the bottom of the barrel and brought it home for Hull. And, you know, that's what we brought those 2 players to Hull for, and they're the halfbacks that we haven't had since your Paul Cook and your Richard Orme days. We've been very blessed that we've had Mark Snead since 2015. Obviously, Albert Kelly came in, did a sterling job for us, and now we've got another one in Josh Reynolds.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's always been the problem with having Snead as a halfback, is to find the right partner for him. Because, you know, when Snead does put his foot down to break the line, occasionally, you know, and because he does it so rarely, that's what takes opposition defences by surprise. If he did it more often, it'd be completely ineffective. But he's an organising halfback. He's not a running halfback, which we've always needed a running halfback next to him, which, you know, was Kelly, and now he's Reynolds. He's a chess grandmaster. You know, he puts his players where he needs them, and then he's got the skills to put the kick or the pass right on the button. And, you know, that's an amazing thing. And, you know, when you look at that England and combined All-Stars game, and you look at the lack of direction given to an England team by Gale or by whoever else has supposedly got the, you know, supposed to be steering that team around the pitch, how Snead is never mentioned in an England context baffles me. And how the hell England can hold their heads up after being beaten by a cobbled together side, and they were cobbled together, that combined All-Star side, just, it beggars belief. It really does.
Absolutely.
Sneed has to be in an England squad.
He does, yeah. Has to be. He does. And we've banged this drum, both of us, you know, in podcasts, in blogs, in anyone that will listen to us in the pub. You know, it's if England had Mark Sneed in 2017, they'd currently be World Cup champions. World champions. I truly do believe that. They had Australia. They had them on the ropes. They had them on the ropes. Only got beat 6-0. They had opportunities to win the game, but Luke Gayle was so far out of his depth at, you know, that day in Brisbane. It was
the most overrated player in English rugby league. He really is. I don't know what he does. Yeah, he must do something spectacular in training because he does. He's steering. I mean, he did. You know, I think he's living off that year that Cass did really, really well, you know, and he was an integral part of that. But you know, I mean, we're late in the scheme of things now. You know, they're nowhere near. They're well off, and a lot of that is because they've got absolutely. I mean, you know, they were camped on our line for how many tackles the game that they played against us, and you know, he had no way of unlocking our defense, no way of unlocking it,
which is embarrassing. You know, the amount of
that is awful.
Yeah,
as a halfback. You know, that is your bread and butter, is to unlock an opposition defence, especially when you've got, you know, 6, 12, 18, 24, 30, 36 tackles on an opposition's line and you cannot find your way through. Well, you're not earning your money. And the fact that he still gets picked for England, joke. Absolute joke.
It is a joke, yeah. What pissed me off as well, and I know obviously injuries didn't help, and funny, I don't know if it was ironic, but obviously the two St. Helens players, Alex Walmsley and Johnny Lomax, called. Obviously, pulled out that squad, and we're left with Morgan Smithies at prop, and there was Ben Curry in. Sorry, not Morgan Smithies, dear me. Morgan Knowles at prop, and Ben Curry in the centre. And I'm sort of thinking, hang on, this is supposed to be a serious warm up game for a World Cup. For a World Cup that might not even happen. It was,
And I don't think, honestly, mate, if I was a betting man, I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, when you listen to NRL and when they mention it in the pundits, you know, on Fox and what have you, they talk about it like it's not going to happen.
No. I think all eyes are on the Olympics at the moment. I think people are going to see how the Olympics pan out. And I think because COVID's made a bit of a comeback, New South Wales is 30, 40, 50 cases this week. They're all Delta variant. It's all starting to get very real again. And, you know, we've got one of the worst vaccine rollouts in the Western world. They've only got 3.5% of people fully vaccinated in this country. So it's going to go, if we get this Delta variant bad, it's going to go through Australia like hot now through butter. Now, already you've got, they're looking at the third origin game's going to have to move out of Sydney because Sydney's in lockdown at the moment. They're talking about maybe playing it in Newcastle. They're also talking about games behind closed doors again, players in bubbles, stage 4 restrictions, all of this kind of stuff. So it's all getting very real again over here. And now, if this prevails, which I can't see it doing anything other, I can't see an Australian rugby league sanctioning players going over to England and then coming back. I just think, on a public health thing, I don't think they'll do it.
No, absolutely. And as I say, the way England goes, also stuff in the UK right now with the government, you just, there's no trust there, not from our part anyway. And you're thinking, when it gets to winter and, you know, you get the flu season and what have you.
Well, that's exactly it. That's what we're in the middle of here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, so yeah, it's your winter right now, isn't it? We have crack of summer, your crack of winter. But yeah, when that changes, and obviously when the World Cup happens, October, November, I just can't see it happening. I really can't.
I can't see the field people
that, you know, like to think they're in the know and in the boys' club and what have you. They've been putting like little subtle hints on Twitter saying, "Oh yeah, it won't happen," and what have you. And
honest, if Friday night's any indicator as to what we can expect from an England squad, we should be bloody well thankful it doesn't happen.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, that was an absolute fastly thrown together, you know, fixture, if you like. England, you know, players dropping out left, right and centre. Same with the All-Stars, Exiles, whatever you want to call them. I mean, what was wrong with Exiles? That was a perfect brand. I don't get that. I don't know if it's because you've got people like Jake Connor, Jermaine McGilvray, who aren't exactly Exiles. Well, I suppose you could say they are because they've been Exiles for the England squad. And very funny to see Jermaine McGilvray get over for a try. Also funny to see Connor pop up with two assists in a big game. I mean, I had a... debate on Twitter with a St. Helens fan last week, and he was saying, oh, what's Connor done in big games? Well, there's a big game against a bloody international side, and he's just ripped them up before he's gone off injured. So there you go.
Yeah. What's he done in a big game? Yeah, okay. Two tries in Denver, dickhead.
Yeah, I mean, ripped the Kiwis up as well on home soil. Yeah. I mean, just ask Joey Manu if Jake Connor's a big game player.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it makes you, honestly, you can't argue with, you can't put brains in statues, mate. You can't argue with some people.
No, you can't. I actually know this person. He is a nice bloke, but sometimes you have to agree to disagree, don't you? I mean, Jake Connor's got a reputation as being a bit of a dickhead. Everyone knows that. He's got that mouth, which we all love. He's one of those people that if he's in your side, you bloody love him. But if you're playing against him, you absolutely hate him. And I get that, you know, a bit of a pantomime villain. But to dismiss his quality and dismiss his class just because you don't like the bloke is ridiculous. Sam Tompkins is your prime example. Absolute bell end. But what a bloody player he is.
Totally. No, you're 100% right. You know, and these players are real. I mean, we you know, just before we start, before you press record, we were talking about Jerome Luai at Penrith. What a player. Young, gifted, and full of it. Absolutely full of it. And screaming in people's faces and laughing when he dispossesses someone, or if someone loses the ball, or if he steps around someone, or he tries saving tackle, he's laughing in the opposition face and everything, which is great, but someone's going to sit him on his ass at some point, you know. The game needs a pantomime villain, you know. It's just the way it is. You're right, you know, just because a bloke isn't a decent bloke doesn't mean he's not a great player.
No, absolutely not. I agree with you. Like, the pantomime villain, rugby league needs characters. You want big personalities and that get people talking. You don't want just a steady Eddie who's boring and don't do anything that makes the headlines. You want someone with a bit of X factor, who's, you know, a cheeky little bugger who could pull off huge plays and then, you know, laugh in people's faces when they make an error and whatnot. And if you're looking at NRL right now, Jerome Luai is probably one of the players that you're thinking, yeah, I want to go to pay to watch him. You know, same over here with your Jake Connors and your Sam Tompkins. They're the blokes that you want to go pay and watch.
Yeah, no, totally. 100%. It's just... that was always what used to stand us apart as a sport. I think the fact that we had people that were instantly recognisable, and you had, you know, even later stages, you know, people like James Lowe's or whatever, or that always go and back chat to referees and people like that were instantly recognisable to people that weren't 100% conversant with our sport. And I just think that we've lost that a little bit. Yeah, and that's why people like Maia Fanua, are really important to the marketing of the game. You know, someone that's, you know, interested in hairdo, you know, gold teeth, bit cheeky, you know, and dare I even say, the idiot at Leeds, you know, who just got knocked out at the weekend, which was some of the funniest footage I think I've ever seen. But, you know, just he dances a lot and all the rest of it, and he might not be a great player, but he's kind of... You know, that's what get the kids interested, and that's what we need. We need those kind of, you know, those recognisable personalities.
No, 100%. I couldn't agree more with that. And yeah, any listener knows our thoughts with Comrade Hurrell. But you can't deny he's a character, you know, he's a personality, and he gets people talking. And like you say, the kids want, you know, they all want, like, they see the hairdo and they think, oh, I won't mind growing one of them little tail things, or don't mind doing a little cheeky dance when I score, you know, in their little amateur game at their community club. And that's the thing, you've got to produce characters in rugby league. And it's a big thing right now, because I look at the England squad, right, and that team, you think 10 years ago, well, not even 10 years ago, 5 years ago, it's got an absolute in-prime Sam Burgess, it's got an in-prime James Graham, an in-prime Josh Hodgson, you know, Elliot Whitehead, people like that. These are huge names within, you know, rugby league as a sport across the whole world, not just in the UK or in the M62 corridor. Look at that England side now. Barring Sam Tompkins, who's got that profile?
Yeah. Yeah, true, mate. True, because you're struggling, aren't you? You're struggling to name... Do you know, this is going to really place me age-wise, but it was an event for me if I saw a rugby league player on national TV. You know, it was an event if there was a rugby league player on a question of sport.
Yeah.
It really was. You know, and even then, you know, they'd put Martin Afaya and they'd call him cross-code player, you know, or they'd put Jonathan Davis, you know, dual international and all this kind of stuff. And they'd always, you know, they'd more often than not put a player that had converted from Union to League because that was interesting to them. You know, and then you go back for that. I remember there was a, oh God, what was he called? There was a halfback, Neil Holding, used to play for, he played for Rochdale, and he played for a lot of Lancastrian teams, and he was a bit of a cheeky bugger, Neil Holding. I think he ended up as the ground announcer at St Helens or something like that, because he played for Saints, but he played for Rochdale, played for Lee, played for a lot of those teams. And I remember turning the TV on one Saturday night, and he was on the Generation game. And I'm like, bloody hell, you know, this guy is like a supremely talented rugby league player. The only time he can get on national TV is he's making a complete ass of himself in front of Bruce Forsyth. But you know what I mean? It was to see a rugby league player on national TV was a proper gob-stopping, you know, stop you in your tracks event. And he's getting that way again now. We've lost a lot of, you know, we've lost a lot of momentum in the sport, and we need to really push. You know, if I was a Super League marketing manager, you'd go to a Hurrell, and you'd go to a Mahia Fanua, and you'd go to a, you know, you'd go to these players that are instantly recognisable, and you'd make them the face of the sport.
100%.
You really would. Whether they're the best players or not, you make them the face of the sport, because it then brings other people that wouldn't normally be around the sport to the sport.
And they need to do this with the English blocks as well. And it's like we're saying right now, England haven't got those huge players, i.e. your Grahams and your Sam Burgess, that they did 5 years ago. But they need to make the current players into those stars. And you sort of think, well, how would you do that? Well, the first thing you do, how you do that is you play fixtures. And the fact that prior to Friday night, England hadn't played since Remembrance Day 2018 is an absolute utter disgrace. And I don't give a crap if we've had a pandemic and obviously the COVID implications that obviously stopped the Ashes series last year. What did they do mid-season, you know, 2020? There was nothing, even before COVID came into our lives, there was still nothing planned for mid-season. Ironically, I'm saying that it would have got called off anyway, but there was nothing planned. 2019, again, no England games planned. There was a farcical, you know, poorly managed and set up at the last minute Great Britain tour, which ended up being a disaster with England getting smashed by Papua New Guinea, never mind Tonga and New Zealand. That there's your problem. You're thinking, right, why don't no one in this country know who the big England players are unless you're involved with rugby league week in, week out? Well, it's because they don't play for a start, but then it's because, as I say, we don't champagne the characters within our game. We don't champagne, you know, the people with, you know, your big attitudes and your big personalities, and they're the people you want. It's like people like Jamie Jones-Buchanan was plastered all over the media because he's a character, and that's why he did rugby AM for all those years. That's why he came on the BBC, because he might not be the best player in Super League or even the best player at Leeds, but he's a character and he gets people talking and he knows the game inside out, and you can he's insightful. You can listen to him and you'll learn something and you'll pick up something, and that's what we need more of.
Oh yeah, I mean you're dead right. I mean it really upsets me that we've got, you know, we've said it week in, week out, we've got a perfect sport. We've certainly got a perfect TV sport. Absolutely, you know, because we are an advertiser's dream and a sports company, a sports TV company's dream, because we're easily packageable. The game doesn't need multiple angle cameras and everything. We're played in a very short thing, you know, because there's 10 metres between the sides, and it's easy to call, it's easy to do, and it's just everything's set up for us to be a success. Everything. And yet, our lack of foresight and our lack of, you know, no matter what you think of the Toronto thing, to actually go out and go, this is the way forward, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, and then can it halfway through the first season, as will leave a lasting legacy of damage on our sport. I think whether you think that the Toronto thing was right or not, you can't go half a year and then cut it. You just can't. Yes, I know COVID was a factor, but that's not Toronto's fault. And it's not the RFL's fault, but you could have done something to keep them going. And, you know, it upsets me that time and time again, we just seem to be we just seem to be allowing this kind of festering depression to settle over our fantastic and wonderful sport.
But it's the best game on the planet. That's never been in doubt, even with its set restarts and its farcical interpretations of head-eye tackles right now, where you can get sin-binned even if a player falls into you. Let's not go there. I'll try not to rant too much about that. Even though I've got problems with some of the rules these days and some of the new things that I brought into the game, it's still the best game on the planet. But the administration of the game, and it's been the same ever since those 21 clubs decided to break away from rugby union and the George Hotel in Huddersfield in 1895, it's never changed. The administration has been shocking. You think all the way back through... I mean, I remember doing a piece last year for Up the Cream on the Floodlit Trophy and thinking, oh, yeah, let's get some of the, you know, the TV money. Obviously, it was obviously ripe in the 60s. It was coming into all sports and rugby league thought, right, let's get a piece of that. We'll create a floodlit trophy competition. Oh, what's the big problem? Oh, nobody has floodlights. Thinking, oh, for God's sake. So obviously Bradford were the first club to install, and then a few others get them. I think the first year it was competed for, it had about three or four clubs in, and then obviously everyone saw the TV money and thought, oh, I'll have a bit of that. But you're thinking that's prime rugby league, isn't it? That is rugby league in a nutshell. And it happened again this week. You know, this fixture, I mean, at one point I think the England Exiles game, Combined Nations, whatever, it looked like it wasn't even going to go ahead. You know, you're thinking there's players dropping out. You know, you've got these COVID problems still in the UK right now, which has seen four Super League games postponed, or obviously five now with the Rovers one. Obviously this week as well, they're not going to Catalan. So you've had five games that have been called off in the past 3 weeks. You're thinking, isn't it a bit stupid then to let players from virtually all Super League clubs mix for a, you know, an exhibition game at best? And you know, it was farcical. You had Sam Tompkins and Tom Davis drive up from south of France, Perpignan, wherever they're based, to come up to Warrington. I mean, that's about an 18-hour drive. We know, because we was going to do it. Well, in fact, we did do it. We got a third of the way there. We got 45 minutes past Calais. Then the bloody game got called off, so we turned around, went back through the Eurotunnel, and ended up staying in some diving Maidstone. I mean, what a trip that is. That's what can't we, you know, that's what you do as fans, isn't it? You know, we're all crazy. There's something, you know, severely wrong in our brain cells sometimes. But, you know, that for two players to do that, to go to an exhibition game, you're thinking, Christ, that's amateur, isn't it? I mean, that doesn't happen in football, really doesn't happen in rugby union, doesn't happen in cricket.
Do you know what? You're right. I mean, the game has shot itself in the foot for years and years and years, and we bang this drum regularly. The one that always gets me, and I'm not playing where worse than you trumps here, but this is the one that gets me, is that when the Super League war was on, and you know, you had players defecting from clubs and you know, people signing directly with the league rather than with a club, and then, you know, getting promised silly money, and some players that were worth, you know, probably 100,000 a year were getting paid 600,000 a year because they were guaranteed a contract if they signed and all the rest of it. You had all of this going on, and in the middle of it, there was a massive press conference, and all the rugby league media all kind of gathered to hear. It was John Rebo saying, oh, you know, we've got this new thing and it's called Super League and it's going to be this and it's going to be that and it's going to be fantastic, and, you know, rugby league's dead in the water around here, and, you know, we're going to get all these new players, and they're going to do this, and they're going to do that, and they're going to do the other. And one of the journalists said, okay, right, and what about referees? And you can literally see on the footage, you can see, it used to be on YouTube, but they've taken it down, but you can see John Rebo kind of looking around going, oh shit, we haven't signed any referees. And the ARL had kind of retained all the referees, you know, kind of registrations and everything. So they had all of these players and all these new clubs springing up and nobody to referee it. I mean, that's basic. You know, you might hate referees, but you need them, you know. So in the end, it was only because one of the high-profile referees decided to jump and a few jumped with him that they actually had people that could actually officiate the games. But at one stage there, I mean, you had, it's like the darts, you know, you've got the two different things going at the same time. You know, you had the ARL and the Super League running rival competitions on rival TV networks.
Yeah, which is, that's just rugby league in a nutshell again, isn't it? And what does make me laugh, and I'm sort of glad you told that story, is because people look at the game in the UK and they think it's farcically run, and then look at Australia and they think it's great. Well, it's not. They're just a basket
it
case.
It really isn't.
You know, I've mentioned it a couple of times in recent weeks, but the NRL, I wouldn't say it's becoming unwatchable, but like I said to you,
it's getting there.
It's getting there, yeah. I don't watch them all religiously now. I won't put them on like a weeknight or, I don't know, on a Tuesday after training, you know, court or anything like that. Cause it don't interest me. I watch Penrith, you know, I might see a result and go, oh yeah, I'll watch that. But, you know, it's not like it's religious now.
No. And you're talking about, you know, the All-Stars game and everything and how farcical that was. You had State of Origin, which is allegedly the pinnacle of the game, certainly over here. And you had Ronaldo Mulitalo named in the squad and up until the morning of the game playing. And then someone in Twitter points out that he didn't move to Australia until he was 14 and the rules say 13. And then the New South Wales get hold of it and go, oh, God, yeah, that's right, actually. He shouldn't be playing. Lodge a formal complaint and he gets turfed out of the squad 4 hours before the game. That's farcical.
That's mental. How's nobody picked up on that? You know, you think he's named in a squad midweek? That's basket case territory, that.
There's the whole thing with what's his name? He was at Warrington now. Albert Kelly's cousin.
Greg Inglis.
Yeah. He's born in Bowraville, which is about an hour north of where I am now, just near Kempsey, which is in the middle of country New South Wales, mid-north coast New South Wales, right? He was born there. He played all his junior football for the Bowraville Tigers and in Kempsey and all around here. He played junior football, right? And he decided when he was 13, 14, he wanted to play for Queensland. He didn't want to play for New South Wales. And then he moved up to Queensland and played a little bit in one of the Broncos feeder clubs, right? I think it was one of Melbourne's feeder clubs, but in Brisbane. But he played all his junior football in New South Wales, but decided right at the death that he was going to go in Queensland. And the fact that every time he scored against New South Wales for Queensland, he was universally hated because he was born and bred New South Wales, but playing for the enemy. And people couldn't understand that. And they made a big play of closing that door and making sure that this could never happen again and everything. And he's actually one of the comedians over here. He's written a song called That's in Queensland, which just lists a load of places where Queensland players were born. Fiji, that's in Queensland, you know, and all the rest of it. Because they just seem to pick, you know, I mean, Ronaldo Mulitalo ruled out on the day of the game. They're bringing Xavier Coates, Papua New Guinea international.
Yeah, it makes,
you know, he shouldn't be playing for bloody Queensland. He's made his decision. He's played for Papua New Guinea. That should be it. You can't chop and change.
Well, they did with Adrian Lamb all those years ago, didn't they? He played for Queensland, obviously, Papua New Guinea. And then you had Petros Sinisiva. Obviously, he was next minute, you know, he was one thing, then playing for Queensland, then playing for Australia. Yeah. And Jared ended it.
Thorne.
Brad Thorne,
you know, played, what was his name as well? He played for Leeds for a while. Played for Australia and New Zealand and Queensland.
Yeah, that's nuts. I said the one I remember is Jared Haynes. Obviously, it's sort of my time when I first started coming up watching the game and thinking, right, as a teenager, he's playing for Fiji. Next minute, he's on the Origin scene after, you know, that amazing 2009 season at Parramatta. Obviously, Origin then gets put in the Australian side, gets dropped from the Australian side back at Fiji. Christ.
Yeah, totally. And the only reason he played for him was because he knew he wouldn't get an Australian shirt. Yeah, that's wrong.
Simple as that. Wrong. It is wrong.
It happens over there as well. You know, you have players playing for Wales or for Ireland or for Scotland, and then they get good enough so that they're suddenly English.
Morgan Knowles is your prime example, isn't it? I mean, he was Welsh up until this week.
Richard Hunt. Richard Hunt, you know, 2000 World Cup was Scottish.
Yeah. Danny Brough was English and then Scottish for 10 years. Slight.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all a farce, but I suppose, you know, there's imaginations like your Waleses, your Irelandses, probably even like your people like Italy as well. They don't have international sides without those roles, do they? It's like the Italy side when it had the Minicello brothers in it, it had, you know, Terry Campese and people like that thrown in.
Yeah, but it only had Anthony Minicello when he couldn't get picked for the Kangaroos.
Yeah, well, same with James Tedesco, didn't he? He played for Italy first, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
There was a few.
Yeah, he did, yeah. His international debut was for Italy, yeah.
Wow.
So was Tony Grimaldi. Tony Grimaldi played for Italy as well.
Yeah, yeah. I remember Anthony Milford playing for Samoa in 2013 when they came to Wool, played a couple of games at Craven Park and... Anthony Milford was up fullback for Samoa, and then next minute he's Queensland. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, okay, man.
It's sort of when it soaks, isn't it? It's like, I just see the thing with Jerome Luai when he said he still wants to play for Samoa, and you had Mel Menengue spitting his dummy out saying, oh, you can't do that. I was like, hang on a minute, mate. You're saying that as a Queenslander. You've done that frigging ever since I was born.
I think Jason Taumalolo really put the line in the sand, because he would have been an absolute shoo-in pick for Queensland every year that they've played it. And he said, no, that's not my heritage. My heritage is Samoa, so I want to play for Samoa. And that's what he's done. He's stuck to it. He's stuck
Tonga.
To it and stuck to it like glue. Tonga, sorry. But he's stuck to it like glue, hasn't he? You know, and the other players that have come around him, you know, and then all of a sudden you've got a really strong Samoa and Tonga side that are giving Australia and New Zealand a real run for the money and beating them.
I was going to say, beating Great Britain, beating New Zealand, beating Australia.
That's great for the game. But, you know, did we capitalise on that? No, we didn't.
Well, that's the thing,
weekend. Oh, wow, that was a shock, wasn't it? And then we moved on.
Where was the Pacific Test this weekend? You've got no NRL fixtures, a standalone Origin event. Where's Samoa Tonga? Or Tonga, New Zealand, Samoa, Fiji, Papua New Guinea, Cook Islands, where are they?
Yep.
It's like over here as well. Where's the French side now? They should have been playing.
Yeah, absolutely they should. Yeah, 100%. And I'll tell you what, right? I watched the Women's State of Origin on Friday night because there was no football on. That's how bad it was. I watched the Women's State of Origin. What a game that was. Queensland 8, New South Wales 6, no set restarts.
Yeah, I did see that.
35-minute halves.
Yeah.
Mate, what a game. It was brutal. Absolutely brutal. About 8,000 people watched it. Sunshine Coast Stadium on the Sunshine Coast, which is just kind of north of Brisbane. It was chucking down, it was blowing a gale, and it was absolutely wonderful. What a game. No set restarts, players ripping in. It was just brilliant. And if you could bottle that, you know, and the fact that it was an almost full, you know, a half full stadium, despite the fact it was chucking down and horrible. If that had been a nice night and the weather had been nice, you'd probably double that. And it was a really, really good game. It was played in really good spirit, but there was a bit of needle in it. And you know, it was fantastic. You know, as the only other game on an Origin weekend, as it is now, what a missed opportunity. You know, you could have had that on the Thursday night. You could have had Tonga Samoa on the Saturday night. And you could have had PNG Fiji or whatever on the Saturday night. And then Origin on men's Origin on the Sunday. You could have made it a weekend of football. It'd have been brilliant.
Likewise over here. I mean, that was poorly thought out to have. I mean, England obviously ticked that box. They're playing that weekend. So played clubs obviously gone, well, we run the game practically now. We're going to play a round on the same weekend. And, oh, yeah, we'll support England. Yeah, we'll do this, we'll do that. Comes round to it. No, we don't want this now. This game's interfering, blah, blah, blah. You couldn't make it up, could you? It's just like, again, it's just Prime Rugby League. And again, that should have been a standalone weekend. We've had two farcical loop fixtures at the start of the year. They didn't need to take place. You know, you start the season at the same time. You've then got two weekends to play with. You've got one as a standalone rep weekend. You've got another one where you don't have to play another, you know, farcically double-headed weekend, which we've got in a few weeks. I mean, that was supposed to be one this week with Rovers and then Salford on the Monday, but obviously the derby's called off now. I mean, there's teams that are playing Wednesday, Monday. There's teams that are playing Thursday, Tuesday this week. You know, it's an absolute farce. And it could have been avoided, but they wanted them two loop fixtures, didn't they? And it's madness. But, yeah, I look at it right now. That England should have played Combine, Nations, All-Stars, Exiles, whatever you want to call it. France should have played. Actually, you'll scrap that. England shouldn't have even played the Exiles. England should have played France in France. England should have played France in France. And interestingly, Sam Tompkins retweeted something on some of his Twitter page, and it was an article of six up-and-coming French players. And there's that Mathieu Laguerre that we spoke about in one of the first podcasts we did this year after he made his debut for Catalans in the first game of the season. And then Steve McNamara saying, yeah, what a debut. The hardest thing he had to do was the post-match interview on Sky because he couldn't have done really speak much English. And, you know, he's obviously come through. He's took this Super League by storm this year. They've got that Arthur Morgan fullback / hooker / wherever the hell they want to play him. You know, there's no substitute for speed, but a little player he is. You know, they've got a couple of massive forwards like Michael Goudmond, you know, Lambert Belmas. They've got some good players, you know, this Catalan side. They've even got some in the French division right now. Look at Toulouse ripping it up. You've got Catalans top of Super League, Toulouse top of the Championship, along with Featherstone, you know, both unbeaten. Yet we can't get a game for France. thinking, come on, boys, let's, you know, switch our heads on here and sort the game out. I mean, England-France should be playing. That should be an annual fixture. And you, like I say last week, and I will repeat it, but you'll go down to Perpignan, you'll go down to Carcassonne. They will give us a bloody game, especially with no NRL players. Absolutely. And just English-based England side. They will give us a game.
Yeah, absolutely they will. Yeah, and that's a matter of pride for them. You know, it's down there. You know, as we say all the time, you know, I mean, the game was almost run out of town by the Nazis. Do you know? That makes French Rugby League the ultimate good guys. You know, they fought Nazism, for God's sake. I mean, you don't get much bigger than that, do you?
No.
It's just the pride that they have that they play Rugby League and not Union. They don't play for the money, because they could make much more money in Union. You know, they play it for pride and they play it for the love of the game. And yeah, they might not be as skillful or as good as a professional English player, but you're never going to give them the chance to actually prove that right or wrong unless you give them the chance to play those games. You know, you've got to do it. You know, I mean, arguably, you know, I mean, I've watched French games, you know, I've seen, you know, Albi play Carcassonne or whatever, and it's they tend to be really skillful, quick games, not particularly big on defence, but very big on attacking flair. And, you know, well, that's what we thought we were getting when we signed Hakim Malouni, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, we thought we'd get that kind of Gallic flair. You know, it's just, I don't know, there's got to be a place for that. And you know, that French side in the 50s was beaten. They were beating the Australians. They were the best team in the world, the French team in the 50s. And, you know, it's a real sleeping giant down there. It's a real shame we can't get that right.
But we've got to help them. It's all right, so, you know, you're the French Federation, yeah. Obviously, had all those assets stripped by the Vichy government, obviously, back in that era, World War II. We've got to still help them. It's our responsibility, you know, especially the Rugby League International Federation. You know, they've got a responsibility as well. But I'd argue the RFL does as well, because we've got those teams playing in our leagues and in our, obviously, in Super League and in the Championship. So therefore, it falls under our responsibility as well to help them out and get them going. And yeah, there is a thing for French Rugby League. It's a massively underappreciated asset in the game of Rugby League, and it could be a lot better than what it is. And there's so much potential there, and we should be, you know, exploiting it. England should be playing France every year. We should be championing it. We should be getting French TV games on our boxes over here. And the fact that they put some of them on YouTube for all to watch speaks volumes. They're trying to push their game out. They're absolutely proud as punch to play Rugby League, as you say. Let's embrace that, and let's make the game grow from there. And it's a massive missed opportunity. While we're talking about growing the game, Hull are doing their bit right now. We spoke about the Sprod Eklik this year, about the academy announcements, and there's been another one that's floating about this weekend. That's Hull's Development Centre in West Cumbria, partnership with Whitehaven. That's exciting to see, because Cumbria is a hotbed for Rugby League. Again, that's an area which has been neglected and underappreciated by many outside of, you know, many people who are Cumbrians. And you look at, you know, Soapley, you've got Carl Amor, you've got Kevin Sinfield, obviously hail from Cumbria, and they've produced players, you know, for 100 years now. And that's good. It can only mean, you know, good things for, you know, selfishly from Hull's point of view going forward. If we can get the best of the talent from West Cumbria, then great. Likewise, we've got one in the south, we've got one in Wales. Obviously, there's the big Elite Performance Centre in Hull right now for the young kids as well on Pickering Road. So, yeah, that all bodes well. I know Hull are obviously getting very noisy about the academy stuff right now, and it is the blueprint. I mean, how many times do we talk about Melbourne Storm and what they've done and the system and the process what Penrith are doing right now? It's the way forward.
Yeah, and it's the... Do you know what? Isn't that one in the eye for the Lancastrian teams that haven't done it? Wouldn't they now sit up and look at that and go, what, Hull? Hull have done this, you know, on our doorstep. You imagine how Wigan and Saints and Warrington and Widnes and you know, they're looking at that going, what, really?
Wigan and Saints are probably that spoiled they get enough from Wigan and Saints, don't they? I mean, Wigan's talent pool alone from Wigan is ridiculous.
Totally, but you look at it and go, well, that's on their doorstep, you know? We're really stealing a match, and you're right, Cumbria is a hotbed of Rugby League, it really is. And, you know, that original Super League season, you know, when Workington were there and everything, and you know, just died a death and everything, the idea was right, and again, it was just that they couldn't back it up with with performances and ended up getting relegated and practically going out of business and stuff. But I mean, originally they were looking at a combined Cumbrian side. You know, when we had that blueprint, which was, you know, Hull merge with Rovers, you know, Wakefield merge with Castleford, and you know, and all of those, and then there'll be a combined Cumbrian team as well. And to be honest, although, you know, merger as a word is disgraceful and anathema to Hull supporters, a merger of the Cumbrian sides would kind of make sense in a rugby league competition. The problem is that you're completely disregarding the feelings of Workington, Carlisle, Barrow, you know, supporters for years and years and years. And that's not to say anything about your Millams and your, you know, your Kells and your amateur clubs up there as well. It's a real opportunity. There are a lot of junior rugby league players up there, and if we, you know, if we get two or three coming through our system and graduating to first grade, it's a success.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the blueprint. We've seen it with Melbourne, I'd say. We've seen it with Penrith right now. We've seen it with St Helens and Wigan in Sub League and Leeds to some extent, as much as it pains me to say it. Bradford too. And, you know, it's got to be the way forward for us right now. And, you know, we did it as well, you know, after David Lloyd buggered off in 2000. We had that smattering of Hull-born players, you know, Paul Kings, Paul Cooks, Kurt Yeaman, Richard Orne. They all came through together and they led the side for the next 10 years. You know, they were brilliant. Yeah. You know, most of those names I just mentioned were Great Britain and England players and arguably some of the best that Soap League produced in that decade. So we've done it before. We need to do it again now. Obviously, it's not an overnight thing, but you've got to be patient with this stuff. But we've seen players come through now. I mean, Ben McNamara, he got another 10-minute cameo on Friday night. He looked decent. He's very composed for a 19-year-old, and that's obviously very exciting to have that, you know, say that composure right now on such a, you know, young pair of shoulders. And, you know, Aidan Beryl getting 2 minutes. All right, 2 minutes. So what? It's still a Hull FC debut. He'll remember that for years to come. He took one carry, couple, you know. He'll love that. Marcus Walker, unfortunately, didn't get on, but it's another player. I mean, I think it was 9 Hull-born players, 8 for our academy. Obviously, Joe Cater coming through the other side, but obviously counts as Hull-born. But, you know, that's half your match day 17. And obviously, I know it's different circumstances, and obviously it was a makeshift, depleted, decimated side, you'll name it. But still to have those players in there to show that they can come in and be relied upon, and in Connor Wynn's case, you know, take the chances. I'd past 2 weeks with, you know, with obviously both fans, he's looked good for it. And you know, we've got Brad Fash now, who's arguably, you know, a mainstay in that 17 for hopefully years to come now, because he's at the age now at 25 where he's going to kick on as a prop. You know, like you just said in your stats, he made over 100 metres again. He never takes a backward step. He's usually error free. You know, he's been absolutely spot on this season, and it's good to see those young players come through. And like I say, that can only get better the more investment we put into that academy and that process and getting everyone under the Hull FC banner. And that's the huge thing. That's what I didn't agree with City of Hull Academy, because it's, although, you know, the people involved will argue it had its positives and it was stronger and blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, it's not Hull FC. And from a Rovers point of view, it's not Hull Kingston Rovers. You want your kids playing for Hull FC, they want their kids playing for Hull Kingston Rovers. I get that. It's all about club identity and the processes and the values that you want to install into your players from a young age. And we get that right. Who knows where we could be in 5-10 years' time?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that's the thing, isn't it? That's what Melbourne do. It's exactly what Melbourne do, you know? They've got centres in Queensland. You know, they steal the best of that Queensland talent from under the noses of your Brisbane Broncos. You know? Think of the amazing Queensland players that never played for the Broncos when Broncos were the preeminent team in Brisbane. You know, Cam Smith never played for the Broncos. Billy Slater never played for the Broncos. Cooper Cronk never played for the Broncos. They all were part of that Melbourne conglomerate of Queenslanders that Melbourne secured at an early age and stole out from underneath them. And if Hull can do that, if Hull can bring up these little spheres of excellence around the place and just steal those youngsters and get them into that whole system and get them imbued in that whole culture and knowing what the team's about, knowing what the club's about, you know?
Culture.
You won't get a more vocal proponent for the Melbourne club than Cam Smith or than Billy Slater. And they were born 1,000 kilometres away from that club. Doesn't matter where they're born, doesn't matter what accent they've got, doesn't matter where they're from. If they get it and you invest in them, they will be yours for life. And that's what we're doing, and that's brilliant.
Yeah, 100%. Funny you say that, because Dominic Manfredi's just announced his retirement, and Wigan put born in Lee, but Warriors through and through. There's your example. You know, born at a club that historically hate Wigan, but obviously he's come through Wigan systems, and now he's, like you say, Wigan through and through. So it don't matter where you're born, it's where you're made. It's where you're made, isn't it? It's where you obviously you make your mark on which club you come through. But yeah, that culture word is huge. And again, it's something that Hodgson is installing at Hull FC right now. We've got an identity. As I say, we've got a culture. We've got values now. You know, you write Hull FC off at your peril, because the fighting qualities within us are outstanding. We're tough. You know, there's that togetherness within the team right now. I mean, this group of blokes would go to war together. I'm absolutely convinced of that, because they are that tight-knitted now. We are a team unit. We're not a set of individuals. We don't back down when the going gets tough. We don't cry wolf when there's a bit of adversity. As I say, as we said at the start of this podcast, we just get on with it. You know, we roll our sleeves up. We are so resilient now. And you'll get the kids and you'll bring them into that culture, that environment. It's only going to bode well for them coming through, but obviously for us as a club right now. And it also, when it comes to recruitment, you're going to recruit better players, because they're going to want to be a part of that.
Yeah. No, you're 100% right. Yeah. And you know, success breeds success. And, you know, a player from the outside, a young player from the outside looking in and going, I want to go to Hull because young kids get the chance there, because I want to be like him. I want to be like that player. And that's what Melbourne have done now for years and years and years over here. And it's what the Roosters have done. The Roosters have stolen so many juniors from Souths over the years. And because Souths at the time, you know, well, they spent some time out of the comp, but the early 2000s, they weren't very good before they won the comp. You actually, you know, you had players like Craig Wing, for example, who, you know, ended up being an Australian international and playing for New South Wales and playing for the Roosters for years, was a Bunnies junior. But looked across at the Roosters and went, no, I want to be like him. I want to do that. You know, I don't want to be here where I'll be the best player in a poor side. I want to be a cog in a machine that wins things. And that's what we've got to get to, you know?
Yeah.
It's what Wigan have been for years. It's what St Helens have been for years. It's what Leeds were 10 years ago. Not now. And it's what Hull need to get to. That's the next step, isn't it? It's all right buying success for a year or two because you astute signings and good coaching and all the rest of it. But arguably what we're doing now is sowing the seeds for something much deeper, much longer term. You know, and it's not sexy. It's not sexy now. It wasn't sexy at Penrith 6 years ago, when they were losing every game and finishing towards the bottom of the league. But bloody hell, it's sexy now, isn't it?
Yeah, when you look at that Penrith side, and they were all born within what? Well, I say within half an hour, it's not the case, because their junior system, that league is huge, but they also go out, they go to Bathurst, they go to Duppo. I mean, when they played that game at Duppo against South a few weeks ago, and they had Liam Martin and Isaiah Yeo that obviously hail from the town, you've got Charlie Staines and Forbes in the middle of nowhere. Suppose you've looked at it at Hull now, it's the equivalent of us signing players from Pocklington, which ironically we've done in Marcus Walker.
Yeah.
It's signing players from Wales, like we've done in Ewan Badham. And it's like, we're, you know, what we're seeing right now with the Cumbria stuff. And if we get it right, there's the blueprint for success, like we say, because we've seen it so many, you know, times before with your Wigginses, with your St Helenses, your Melbourne Storms, your Penrith Panthers. Get it right, then, you know, bring it on. As I say, what we've got to do is keep our eye on the prize. It's no, as I say, how many times do we hat back on to 2016, 2017, and how we didn't kick on in 2018, and how we went stale, and how that, you know, we didn't progress as a club. We were content on what we achieved. We saw that in recruitment, but we saw that in how we were with the Cityville Academy. You know, that was, as I say, I don't care what anyone says, it took us back a few years for me in terms of the players you bring through, in terms of identity, in terms of, like you say, values and systems and processes. And it just wasn't the right things to do. And we saw that with the recruitment. It was stale for 2018. It was stale for 2019. It was rectified for 2020. But when you've gone, as I say, 3 years where you've been stale, where you've took your eye off the prize, you don't just get that back overnight. You need someone to come in and reignite that fire again. And that's what's happened with Bradson. And that's why he's been so successful, because he's done that from day one. He's made sure that we get all the hard stuff. We do the hard work first. We get our defence right. You know, we make sure we fight to the last breath. We know we never give up. We never throw the towel in, blah, blah, blah. You get all those qualities right. Then you worry about your attack. Then you worry about this and that. And we've seen that with all right now. As I say, we've got those foundations into place. And hopefully they'll continue. They won't go anywhere. You know, we're starting to sign the players we want now, but you know, Chris Sattar's signed up by all accounts, Jake Connors signed up, so we are definitely going in the right direction as a club, both in terms of our squad right now, our first team squad, but also with our academy for the future as well. And yeah, and that's great to see. It shows that we're planning beyond a 1 or 2 year flash in the pan success. We're planning for something a bit more long term.
Yeah, brilliant. And I think the final word on, you know, players that are not born in the local vicinity that the club takes to heart. You've only got to look at the way that we still revere and celebrate players like, you know, Luluai, O'Hara, Kemble, Sterling, Clive Sullivan. You know, if you're a fit and you get it and you buy in, you're one of us. And that's something that whole team throughout the years and the whole club throughout the years have been absolutely famous for. And, you know, when you've got a player like James Grant and Dave Brooks saying to me, a Balmain thing, and they only played for Hull for a year or two, you know, it's not a club rich, it's family. Then that's what we need to nurture, and that's what we need to absolutely celebrate the fact that we're more than a club, you know. And if we get this right, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. Now we're investing in the future. We just can't screw this up.
No, absolutely not. And hopefully we won't. It would be typical Hull for us to do so. But right now, I think we've got the right people within our setup. Like you say, with your Brett Hodgson, with your Gareth Ellis's, and with your Kieran Patels as well. I mean, nobody hears a thing from Kieran Patel, but that's a good thing. You know, it doesn't matter. He's an assistant coach. He has his voice within that squad. Players will all get on with him. You know, they'll obviously respond to what he's telling them. It doesn't matter if we don't hear about him in the media. That's probably a good thing. You know, I've got no issues with that. And what I love about us as well is we're bringing through the right type of players. I mean, last year, before before COVID came into place, there was a couple of reserve games at Brantingham Park. Max Need was part of the coaching staff, you know, helping those young lads, you know, giving them, you know, a bit of advice, and obviously on the touchline, and, you know, just trying to help them out and give them a shoulder. And you can't buy stuff like that. Josh Reynolds as well did so much stuff in Sydney and in New South Wales, as I'm sure you'll know more than me, within the community side of the game. It's about bringing through the right type of people as well, isn't it? And I think, yeah, we're starting to see that right now. And, you know, it's like Chris Sattar, you think, what a player, but what a bloke as well. He's like literally one of the nicest people you'll ever meet. And it's just things like that as well, which I love to see. And as I say, there's the catchphrase, long may it continue. A couple of shout-outs on that front. One to our regular listener, Phil Hemsworth, who put a nice message on Twitter. Cheers, pal. And also Ian Fresh, who was a bit of a dinosaur. Hates the fact that I don't do this on radio anymore. But it must admit, he spoke to him on Saturday morning. He sat literally right behind Ian Watson in the West Stand. As we beat Huddersfield, and he did not stop giving him shit for the full 80 minutes. I thought that's just, anyone who knows Ian Fresh will know that is even to a capital T. And yeah, it's just be careful what you wish for, innit? And a lot of people obviously wanted Ian Watson, but you know, fair play to the club because we pulled the masterstroke off there getting Brett Hodgson to our club.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think looking at the job he's doing at us, I think we might have dodged a bullet there.
100%, mate. 100%. But yeah, there's the catchphrase, long may it continue. Finish off then our Hull FC NRL Australian club connections. We have obviously done the Wallowa Dragons and this original St George club over the past fortnight. So now we've got the merger, the St George Illawarra Dragons.
So there's not many, but there are some names to conjure with. Craig Fitzgibbon, who started his career at St George, obviously more known for being a Roosters player before he came to Hull, but Craig Fitzgibbon's in there. Luke Felsh, who we mentioned last week, they were both two players that finished in the last season of the old St George club and then played for a year with the new St George Illawarra club. As did Nathan Blacklock. Let's have a bit of a chat about Nathan Blacklock, because As a winger, I mean, he had a pretty ill-fated stint in rugby union. But as a winger, what a strike rate. For Hull, 51 appearances, 35 tries. What a strike rate that is for a winger. And overall in his career, 201 appearances, 104 tries. So a try every other game. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Willie Manu as well had a season at St George before he went to the West Tigers and then came to Castleford and then to us.
One of my favourite players of that era, Willie Manu. Had all the tricks, didn't he? All the flicks and the tricks, but it was tough as well.
Yeah, great player, and you know, a very unselfish player as well. I had to double check his stats actually, because you know, I thought, well, eight tries isn't that good a return, is it really, when you consider the amount of line breaks he used to make and all the rest of it. But it was because, you know, he'd make a break and then he'd put his winger away, or he'd pass back inside for a fullback or whatever. So he was a very unselfish player, Willy Manu, and a real cornerstone of that whole pack for a few years. Daniel Holdsworth as well, the halfback that we had for a year. He was a St George player. Matt Head as well, who we had for, I think we only had, did we only have Matt Head for half a season?
Not even that. It was about, he made his debut at Rovers in a 30-20 win. The one where all the fans went on the pitch and clashed, and it was Paul Cook playing for Rovers. And
Yeah,
it was a bad day. Not a good look for the city of Hull as a sport. But yeah, Matt Head made his debut, I say, that day. Played probably about 10 games top. So he played in that win at Leeds in the rain where Hull won 17-6. Yeah, also he played in the two playoff games as well against Huddersfield and Wigan. I think that night we lost 18-21, and Richard Orme was like a whisker away from winning the game for all that day. But yeah, he had his moments, did Matt Head in Hull FC shirt. I think he wanted to stay, didn't he? But then Hull had already tied up Adam Dykes for the year after. And
Adam Dykes, Jesus. He ended up back at the West Tigers. He played half a season at the West Tigers, and then his knees went, and he just had enough after that, I think, which was a shame, because he was a really, really skillful player, Matt Head. And yeah, unfortunately, just one of those players that injuries seem to get the better of him. You know, I think he only made under 100 NRL appearances. Because, you know, I think the biggest season he ever had was St George Illawarra in 2004. He played the full season. Season after, he played 10 games, injured. 14 games the year after, injured. Next year, he hardly played at all, injured. Then he came to us, didn't get re-signed, went to West Tigers, half a season, injured, and then retired halfway through the 2009 season with injury as well. So, I mean, he's a good coach as well. He coaches the St George Illawarra Jersey Flag team, I think, and he's been there or thereabouts every time people have mentioned head coach roles. And I know I sang his praises as a possible old coach before we got Hodgson, but you know, I think he'll end up being a career coach, Matt Head. He was a very skillful player, and he's a good student of the game. And the other one as well that we need to talk about is Colin Best, who we've spoken about a couple of times now. But and again, we talk about Nathan Blacklock's strike rate as a winger. Colin Best, 63 appearances for Hull for 41 tries.
Yeah, that's not
that's
bad.
That's pretty impressive.
Not bad as a centre. I say he played a few games at centre as well as on the wing. But I always remember Richie Barnett, I think it was in the 2004 season, literally sprinting full pelt down that right touchline, and Best is like literally not even breaking stride, like jogging, like, give me the ball then, pal, so I can race home. Yeah, he had some speed, didn't he? Colin Best, and obviously came over, obviously went back to Australia and had a stellar career, you know, post-Hull FC as well, which is a rarity. You know, we saw it with Jamie Lyon at St Helens, who did the same thing, but I think it is a rarity for a player to come over to England, but then excel back in Australia, sort of make his name over here, but then excel back in Australia. It was the other way around, didn't it? They excel in Australia, then come to England for, I won't say a last payday, although that is the case in some, it must be said, but usually they come over England to like pull on the career a little bit, don't they?
Started and finished his career at Cronulla, and I think I might do Cronulla next time out as well, because there'd be a few there with Cronulla. But he started and finished his career at Cronulla, and you know, 15 years apart from the start to the finish, played 15 seasons. Short stint at St George, couple of years at St George, couple of years in Canberra, couple of years at Souths, and a couple of years with us. You know, so he's, you know, when he came across to Hull, 2003-2004 season, he was a regular first grader at the Sharks, and at that time, 2003, obviously because we had Sean McRae in charge, he'd had a lot of dealings with the Sharks, and we got a lot of players from the Sharks. You know, we had Sean Ryan and Adam Maher, who'd all come through the Sharks system, obviously Colin Best as well. We had Dean Treister for a while as well, who was ex-Sharks as well. So we ended up getting quite a few Cronulla Sharks through the books, but he was a good player before we got him. He was a very good player when we got him, and he was a better player after we had him as well. You know, the year he went back to the NRL, he scored 20 tries, and was the Dally M winger of the year. for St George. So yeah, a very, very good player, Colin Best, and it was nice for us to get a player at the start, towards the start of his career, rather than someone coming over looking for a pension plan.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Just makes a nice change, doesn't it? But yeah, some good players there. Must admit, watching Nathan Blacklock, his hat trick at Warrington when we sent Andrew Johns packing, that was obviously the standout moment. But
yeah,
you know, obviously,
first half hat trick.
Yeah, one of the try scorers as well as Hull FC. So I didn't know one of the try scorers, but he assisted the pass to Gareth Reno when we scored at Cardiff as well.
Yeah.
Which obviously a huge moment. Yeah. Had his moments in a Hull FC jersey and was very well liked, and it was sad to read a few years ago he was battling depression as well, which you know, never nice to read. And also he had problems with racism as well, you know, racist abuse thrown at him, which is obviously disgusting to read. Well, I mean, we know that more than most after seeing the stuff of Andrea Savelio at Wigan last month.
Yeah. I've caught up with Nathan a couple of times over here, actually. I caught up for a beer with him. He was doing a Hugs for Homeless thing where they ride bikes around New South Wales with Freddie Fittler, actually. And I had a very boozy night with Nathan Blacklock and Mark O'Mealy a couple of years back in one of the local pubs up here in Port Macquarie. And the funny thing that happened that night was I had my whole shirt on, and O'Mealy made an absolute beeline for me, and he was pushing people out of the way to get to me to talk to me, which was just really, really cool. And Danny Badiris was there as well, and my mate said, "Oh, do you want me to take a photograph of you and Oga?" And I said, "Yeah, that'd be great." And Badiris kind of stood there next to me, expecting to be in the photo. And Mark O'Mealy said, "Piss off, you Leeds twat." Oh, I thought, "Oh, that's brilliant." So I got a very nice photograph, one with Nathan and one with Mark O'Mealy, which, yeah, very, very cool.
Not one with Danny Badiris?
No. Danny, me and Danny Badiris don't see eye to eye, apparently. So it's all good.
Brilliant. That again, that's what we speak about, and that's what we've spoken about for the past, you know, couple of segments of this podcast, is building a culture, building an identity where people want to be a part of it, but then people remember it as well, and that's a key thing for Hull FC right now. And as I say, under Brett Hodgson, we are, see, it was a massive cliche, we are ticking all those boxes.
We are, and let's tick our final box and say, and long may it continue.
Absolutely. Thanks for your time, mate, and all the best.
Cheers, mate.